I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, James, we are talking to David Harbour about his Bad Santa action comedy Violent Night, and we're rating that plus Noah Baumbach's White Noise, David Lynch visual essay Lynch Oz, and Netflix's new take on D.H. Lawrence's classic Lady Chatterley's Lover. But before we get onto those, what else have you been watching, James?
Do you mean apart from the World Cup? Is there time to watch anything apart from the World Cup? No, I have managed to squeeze a couple of extra films in around, Cameroon, Serbia, which obviously is a crucial game. I know you know that. We'll come to it a bit later, of course. But through watching the David Lynch essay Lynch Oz, it prompted me to go back to rewatch Lost Highway, which features in that essay, and yes, I just absolutely adore that film. That's just one of my favourites, basically. So that was a real treat. I can tell by the look on your face, not one of your favourites.
We'll get to it, but God no.
Okay, we can discuss Lost Highway later in depth. I also managed to catch the new Spielberg film, The Fabelmans, this week.
Yes.
I don't know how much
I've
we
seen
can
it.
Talk.
Yeah, we're not allowed to say, are we? We're allowed to say in our sort of general terms whether we liked it, but we're not allowed to go into specifics. But did you like it?
I did. Yes. It's very Spielbergian, I suppose we could say, but also very different because it's not a huge sort of big scale spectacle, which he's obviously famous for. There's lots of great stuff in it, though, but we'll have to come to that on another pod.
I mean, it's definitely going to be in the awards conversation. There are performances in that are you can't ignore. I would say Michelle Williams is absolutely going up against Cate Blanchett for the Best Actress award.
I would have to pick Kate if I was going to choose between the two. I mean, we saw Tar together. I remember that in Venice. And that's one of those films that's still sort of knocking about in my brain, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, I've only just seen The Fabelmans, so we'll see how that sits in a couple of months' time. But yeah, Tar is kind of a very interesting film, I think.
Which we saw together, didn't we? It was our first film that we saw at the Venice Film Festival. And it was so sort of in your face that we came out reeling, not really knowing what to think about it, didn't we? And we talked a lot about it afterwards, which is always the sign of a sort of intriguing film when you see so many at festivals. The ones that you're like, yeah, liked it, and carry on to the next screening are not the ones that stay with you. But Tar really was something that we really were sort of chatting about all sorts of aspects of.
And given it was literally the first film we saw in the two weeks of that festival, and the fact you're still thinking about it, at the end of the festival and onwards, that's always a good sign.
Isn't it?
What have you been watching this week?
I haven't, because I'm on deadline, so no.
Right, not watching the World Cup then, clearly.
I'm not watching, I haven't been watching the World Cup because I have no interest in any kind of sport. I don't know if this makes me sort of like a psychological anomaly, but literally sports movies do nothing for me and sport in its entirety.
Hang on a minute. Sports movies do nothing for you, and yet Kevin Costner did Tin Cup.
That does nothing for me. I mean, Costner does something for me, but the film
Tin
doesn't.
Cup?
No.
Tin Cup?
No, just saying it repeatedly doesn't make it good.
No, you should just say the words Tin Cup. I think you should revisit that as your homework.
No, Bull Durham, I can kind of get on with because it's not so much about the baseball. It's about, the relationships and having sex with Susan Sarandon, which I'm down for. But yeah, sports movies leave me utterly cold, as does every kind of sport. I would rather do anything else than watch sport.
What about Next Goal Wins? You haven't seen it yet, of course, but this is Taika Waititi's new film, which we're previewing in the next issue, which I got to interview him for. And that's all about the worst ever international football side, American Samoa, who lost 31-0 to Australia. That's got Cool Runnings written all over it, basically. No, I can see your face. It's just not doing it for you, is it?
It's just not doing it at all. No, I mean, no. No, I'm sorry. I don't know if this makes me broken. Perhaps it does. But it just, the only one, in fact, the only one that bucks that trend is Rocky, obviously. But that's, again, because it's not entirely about the sports business. It's about him. And I can get on board with that. But yeah, it's just an absolute no-no for me. Cannot stand it. So there we go.
Right.
Shall we move on and see if any of the films that we've got coming up this week are yes, yes, rather than no, no? Shall we start with this? It is time to find out who's been naughty and who's been nice.
Santa Claus is coming to town. Time for some season's beatings.
Who the hell are you?
Boss, what if he really is the real?
There's no such thing as Santa.
Yeah! These bad men, they're all on my naughty list. Naughty.
That's naughty!
And what do you do to the naughty ones?
I give them a lump of coal.
Where is it?
I gotta watch.
Ah! I believe in you, Santa.
So this is Violent Night, starring David Harbour as a fed-up Father Christmas who pops down the chimney of a wealthy clan, only to discover John Leguizamo and his goons have held the family hostage for their vast fortune. Santa isn't about to play nice and uses all manner of festive paraphernalia to dispatch the crooks. Before we get on to whether this is a Christmas treat or a lump of coal, shall we listen to what David Harbour had to say about playing Saint Nick and how his own family dynamic prepared him for the role? And what we might expect from Thunderbolts when I sat down to chat with him last week. Just so you know, he was sitting on a fake snowy roof with reindeers in the background, and I was in Total Film Towers on a Zoom with nothing festive at all. So he feels very Christmassy. Perhaps I don't. Let's listen. I'm a big fan of Bad Santa, so I like Santa going wrong. But I just wondered for you growing up, who was your cinematic Santa? Who was the one that you thought of when you thought of Saint Nick?
It was Miracle on 34th Street, the old black and white movie about the Macy's Santa, who is the real Santa. And I remember all those scenes with her pulling his beard and realizing it's real. And then the end of the movie when the house, and there's his cane in the house that she always wanted. And you realize, and the parents realize, maybe he actually was the real Santa. I mean, I always cry.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're a fan of a sort of traditional nice Santa, but this is obviously not so nice. He's a bit on the naughty list himself. So when you were offered the chance to play such a badass Santa, what part of it were you really looking forward to?
Honestly, the paradox of those two things. I mean, for me, the heart of the movie is Miracle on 34th Street. It's that last scene with the girl where he says to her, "You gave me my ho-ho-ho back." I mean, that to me was the real focus of what I was trying to bring to the movie, because the movie already had the badass action, had a lot of the comedy, it's wacky, it's a crazy idea. So how do you ground this in people that you care about? And what you really got to focus on for him is this relationship with this little girl who he sees struggling and who he knows she needs something to believe in and someone to believe in. And she also needs to be saved from bad guys. So it was really a focus on that. And the other stuff really kind of took care of itself. I find the badass sort of action-y stuff, while it's physically difficult, it sort of comes more naturally. But really digging into that relationship was really important to me.
Was that quite difficult tonally for you to sort of do those scenes with the little girl that are very sweet, but then in other scenes you're sticking, you know, fairy light stars in people's eyes and lopping off people's heads with garden equipment? Was that sort of quite a tricky thing to negotiate?
It was surprisingly, they went hand in hand. And I liked when it was actually very quick. There's one sequence where, you know, he stops someone, kind of meets her, has this emotional moment with her, and then has to go finish somebody off. I think what we said was he's like, just sing Jingle Bells really loud or something as he goes off through this day. But there was something about loving and protecting this little thing and then having to be really angry at these people that are threatening that thing that I found really easy to switch from that sweetness to this violence. It was actually when it was just violent or just sweet that it was harder. When the two were together, it's like peanut butter and chocolate or something. They seem to augment each other.
Right. It's like a peanut butter cup in action.
Exactly.
What you're saying.
It's an emotional peanut butter cup.
Of all of those dispatches, was there a favorite? Because some quite inventive ones.
I mean, they're all so good. There's so many crazy ones. I mean, there's this thing with an ice skate that, like, pretty gnarly. That candy cane is no joke. The Star of David and somebody's, you know, then plugging it in. Lots of good ones.
Yeah. And how was it sort of performing those stunts in the full Santa gear with the padding? Tricky?
Yeah, brutal and awful. The beard in particular was the worst part because the suit's fine. You're padded. It's good for joints and stuff. You don't get hit as much. But that beard, there'd be takes where we'd like someone swing somebody around, you flip them, you do this incredibly great take, and then you spin and look off towards the guy, and your beard would just be hanging off like this. And then you cut, got to do it again.
Yeah. So no real hair involved in this one then?
No, I didn't have time to, we couldn't make it work. So I had to, we had to do, it's all fake, but the wigs are incredible. So they look great when they stay on.
Mm. And how much training did you do with the hammer? The hammer is very important to this Santa Claus.
Yeah.
There's some decent swinging with that thing.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I worked on that a lot. There was a, you know, I was up in, we were up in Winnipeg shooting it in 20 below weather. So you couldn't go outside. So right. You just sit at home and eat, you know, bad delivery food. And I would just like swing that hammer around back and forth. They gave me one to take home to my apartment. So I got kind of facile with it. And it's a fun little weapon to use because it's kind of like a sword, but it's got a big old weight at the end. So you're constantly having to counterweight it with your body. But yeah, it was really fun. I like a long, long, sturdy weapon.
I also like the idea of this film, really sort of, you know, you've touched on it so far, but the idea that it's saying in this world, we do need a great deal more kindness. Was that an important message as well? That, you know, these people are horrible that you're coming down the chimney to. And this idea that we could all do with a bit more kindness in our lives at the moment.
Yes. Yes. But it's funny because there's also that message in there, which is sometimes, you know, what Santa feels is that this part of him that he's discarded, which is this Viking nature, this old nature that is violent, that sometimes that's necessary to invest and to really be heroic, that you can't just sort of be kind and give little gifts and then disappear. Sometimes you got to get involved in situations and you got to fight. And I think that's one of the funny things about this particular Santa Claus is the things that he thinks people love him for, which is like being sweet and jolly and like, you know, saccharine, is what this girl tells him. We don't need that guy right now. We need a guy who's going to really be nice, whatever that word means. Right. So, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. And do you think like this role sort of arrived in your life where you understand that sort of need to protect a family, and that it's sort of dovetailed nicely, and that maybe you couldn't have played this earlier in your career or, you know, at different times, that it's actually arrived at the right time for you?
I definitely feel like there is a kismet. I don't know if it's biofeedback or whatever it is, but like there's a kismet to what comes to you and what you gravitate toward. Sort of your inner nature as an artist and as a human being is generally expressed, and generally that when you express it, you know, purely audiences like that. And so I do feel like as I develop as a human being or grow as a human being into all these different realms, that the material that comes to me reflects that. And that's one of those things. Like I do have a family now in a different way, and I do understand those relationships and that feeling of protecting people much in a much deeper way now.
Do you see as well that sort of correlation between this Santa and Red Guardian in a way, that their sort of traumatic backstory, red outfit, brute strength, pissed off? And what do you think with Red Guardian going into the Thunderbolts, we're going to get from that film?
Yeah, I do see the parallels, but Santa is purer. I mean, Red Guardian's a real narcissist and he's got real blockages around what reality is. I think Santa's much more incisive. He's much more self-hating. I think Red Guardian's more self-aggrandizing. There's probably deep self-hatred underneath that, but it manifests itself in different ways. In terms of going forward, this Thunderbolts movie is very exciting. I know the arc of it. I know the story. Haven't read a script yet, but it's got some really major plot elements for the MCU in general. Mm-hmm. And then it's also just got great relationship stuff in it. It's got, you know, more Yelena and Alexei, which is something we've seen in Black Widow, but we will develop further in this movie. And then it's got all of these great morally complicated characters who also are kind of losers, like, you know, Wyatt, Sebastian's character, and Ghost character, all these different characters. So again, I think it'll be a pretty unique movie in this MCU universe. And the director's great, and the whole team is great. So I can't wait to get to work on it.
Thank you so much for your time today. And I should probably wish you a Merry Christmas, since it's looking so Christmassy where you are.
Merry Christmas to you too.
Yay. So James, there's David talking about Violent Night. He's sort of selling this as a sort of good fun, tongue-in-cheek, violent comedy actioner that you're going to want to go and see with your mates and jingle all the way. Did it do it for you?
It's one of those films, I kind of enjoyed it while I was watching it, but it's sort of left my memory quite quickly. I can't really recall very many of the violent methods that he dispatches with John Leguizamo's goons. I vaguely remember someone getting set on fire. But come on, James.
There's the use of a skate. There's definitely a wood chipper involved. There's a star of David off the Christmas tree. There is a burnt head. There's many, many imaginative uses.
They're very inventive, for sure. They just sort of, there are so many of them, though. I think that's why they all just blurred into one giant, you know, bloody mess on the snow. I mean, I was sort of more interested with it as I suppose it's this typical thing now in Hollywood where someone will go, right, I've got a great idea. It's Bad Santa meets Die Hard, which is exactly what this film is. And, you know, the twist being, of course, that the Santa Claus is not, you know, someone playing Santa Claus. It's the real Santa Claus, which is a nice idea, I have to say. I like that aspect of it. And when we first meet him, he's kind of in this bar, like a sort of boozy, you know, boozing it up. And you sort of think, oh, he's going to be like Billy Bob Thornton's character in Bad Santa, who was just a sort of boozy womanizer playing, you know, Santa Claus in department stores. And of course, it turns out he's got the reindeer on the roof of the bar that he's in, and he is, you know, he is for real. So that I liked. But then you have the sort of blatant references to Die Hard. Now, obviously, you've got a bunch of crooks trying to, you know, jack open a vault. That is, you know, the essential plot of Die Hard. But then at some point, somebody mentions having Die Hard on Blu-ray, which is a bit like, that's just too on the nose, really. It's a bit like the script is a bit too knowing and sort of pleased with itself. Then you've got the sort of slightly strange aspect of all these characters in this rich, wealthy family, the Lightstones, are pretty horrible. None of them really deserve saving, with the exception of the young sort of granddaughter who, you know, who still believes in Father Christmas and is a very sweet girl. And all she wants really are her parents to sort of sort out their marital problems and get back together. And that just doesn't really belong in a film when like this, which is sort of, I think it's a 15 rated film, but it's quite violent. And it just seems
sweary.
Yeah, it seems rather Disney-fied sort of subplot that doesn't really belong in the film at all, and is trying to give you this, you know, warm and fuzzy feeling of Christmas spirit at the end, and something that the David Harbour Santa Claus kind of, it gives him a motivation, let's say, and that didn't really work at all. I mean, but you know, as a let's go down the pub and then watch a film with lots of violent dispatches of villains, it works perfectly well.
Yeah, I mean, it's unavoidable to not think about Bad Santa when you're looking at this. And I think Bad Santa managed tonally to walk that line between being, you know, debauched and funny and filthy, but also having that heart to it with the child. But the child part of it was still quite debauched and filthy and wrong. Whereas this is really trying to walk the line between the debauched and this very, very sweet girl and this sweet relationship that she has with both her parents, but also with Father Christmas as well. You know, there's this very curious scene where he tells her to turn around whilst he horribly murders a henchman. And that's like sits very weirdly for me. So that did, yeah, you're right, it didn't work for me tonally, but also it really felt like it ran out of steam. It was like, this is a concept movie. You're right, somebody went into a room and said, David Harbour, badass Santa, dark past, you know, actually comes across some naughty people, and what does he do with them? For 5 minutes or of him doing that, that's fun. But then it's literally the same trick repeated. And yeah, it's very difficult to care about any of this family. And obviously the henchmen you don't care about at all. They are literally faceless people to be wood chipped or skewered.
Faceless goons,
to be dispatched. It's kind of empty, isn't it? It's a sort of empty, hollow film. But in terms of just an empty sort of, as you say, sort of Christmas cheer that you just want to go with your mates and have a 90-minute bit of idiocy that you forget immediately, maybe this is the thing you want at Christmas, especially if you're anti the sweet Christmas movies. This is the other end of it. And also, like, can we talk about the idea of this film playing in England, where it opens in Bristol, England, in a bar that clearly never exists in Bristol, with people who don't speak like that, American actors doing their version of Cockney. That really, ooh, you know how I feel about an accent. That set my teeth on edge.
Yeah, David Harbour really should know better, given that he's, you know, married to a Brit and
lives here quite a lot of the time. Yeah.
The Bristol opening sequence was very strange. I mean, that bar could have been anywhere. In fact, I'd entirely forgotten it was set in Bristol until you mentioned that.
And he takes off,
because it kind of looks like a New York style bar inside.
And he takes off on the reindeer off a skyline that is clearly not Bristol, has no recollection of any kind of Bristol buildings. It's very strange. I don't even know why that happened. But yeah, so as long as you can sort of swallow that and swallow, you know, various other suspensions of disbelief, you're probably going to have fun with it, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we should say David Harbour is great in the role, because he's such a charismatic actor to watch. Obviously, people know him from Stranger Things and Black Widow not so long ago, things like that. And he's just sort of, he just brings so much to his characters. And yeah, you're right, there isn't a lot to this film beyond sort of, you know, carnage, but you do care about him. I wish we oddly, there's a few references to sort of Mrs. Santa Claus.
Yes.
And it would have been nice to perhaps to have had scenes with them somewhere. That might have added a little more depth to the film, possibly. I mean, you know, they might argue they didn't need to add any depth to it, but it might have added a little emotional sort of dimension. Could Lily Allen have played Mrs. Santa Claus? I don't know.
Well, she's a talented actress. I saw her in 2-2-2, A Ghost Story, and she's very good in that. Why couldn't she be Mrs. Claus? Maybe in Violent Night 2, which, if this does well, is surely on the cards and coming down a chimney next year. Maybe that could happen. But yeah, Harbour's great in it. And, you know, there is a little bit of Red Guardian in this. There's elements of that sort of character in his portrayal here. So if you love his work, and you just enjoy watching him, this is going to sort of push those buttons, isn't it?
Yeah, and I should add a couple of other, you know, decent performances. John Leguizamo, who did feature in Die Hard 2. So I think, I'm not sure if that is a covert reference to that film, but obviously there's quite a lot of snow in this film, obviously, because it's set in the winter, and there's snowmobiles and things like that, and there's a lot of snowmobiles in Die Hard 2, so I'm fairly sure they're referencing that there. And then, just because I think she's an actress that who's been around a long time, but perhaps doesn't always get, you know, as greater roles as she deserves, Beverly D'Angelo as Gertrude, the sort of matriarch of this awful wealthy family. She's a lot of fun. And, you know, frankly, I remember her back from the National Lampoon's films in the 80s with Chevy Chase. And I loved her in those. So I'd love to see her in more stuff. She's great.
Yeah, she is an old maven in this, isn't she? And really getting her teeth into being an unpleasant character. I think we're saying it's a prezi worth opening for Christmas if you're into David Harbour.
You've done all your Christmas shopping. You've had a couple of eggnogs. And then why not just pop in and see it?
Okay, so that is Violent Night, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, so from one grumpy man to another, it's this.
Do sheep have lashes?
Ask your father.
We're going sideways.
Dad, do sheep have lashes?
Doesn't anyone want to pay attention to what's actually happening?
I wish there was something I could do. I wish I could outthink the problem.
There are two kinds of people in the world. Killers and dyers. Most of us are dyers.
Right now we're safe. As long as the children are here, they need us.
Of some persistent sense of large-scale ruin, we keep inventing hope.
So this is White Noise, which we also saw at Venice Film Festival together, James. It feels like we've been on dates on all of this. You know, like, we don't just see films together, but we did see this one at Venice. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Right. So this is White Noise by Noah Baumbach. It is based on the Don DeLillo novel. And it's sort of set in the 80s. It's set in a kind of, well, I suppose, fictional college town. College on the Hill is the name of the academic institution where Adam Driver's character, Professor Gladney, works. Bizarrely, he's a teacher of Hitler studies, if you can believe that. It's kind of a family saga. The first third of the film concentrates very much on him, his wife, Babette, played by Greta Gerwig, and they've got a bunch of kids from previous marriages together, as well as one of their own. And, you know, the first third is really just observing their relationships. And then a very strange incident happens. A truck crashes into a train, like an oil tanker, spilling this huge toxic chemical spill. And there's suddenly this enormous cloud. They call it the toxic airborne event. That's kind of heading towards the town, which sets a huge panic, in motion amongst the whole residents. And we should sort of add that Driver and Gerwig's characters are sort of both obsessed by death and who will die first. So clearly this is going to exacerbate their paranoia. And the film kind of goes on from there. I won't say too much more as to where it goes in the final third. It's very much a sort of film of thirds, really, as there's these sort of distinct chapters. It's very, very hyper-stylized in places. You have a supermarket that turns up in several scenes, which is these kind of bright primary colors with all the products arranged in these sort of incredibly neat rows. It's an odd sort of setting.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, even in giant supermarkets that you have in America, it's not quite as colorful as this. So it's a slightly unreal world that we're entering into that's just notched above, you know, one notch above reality, let's say.
Yes. So speaking of unreality, as I watched this film, a bat was flying around the auditorium when we watched this in Venice.
I'd forgotten that. Oh my God, that was added
to the level of weirdness.
That was really distracting me. I was quite freaked about, oh my God, it's going to fly. It was nowhere near me, but I was thinking, oh, it's going to fly into my hair, obviously, because that's the paranoia that you get about bats.
It flapped around all over, which frankly didn't bother me because I really wasn't enjoying this. The bat.
You were too distracted by the bat.
The bat provided me with more entertainment than the film, frankly. This is a very tricky one, isn't it? Because you really do have to buy into the tone of this and the arch dialogue and the very big performance that's going on in this film. Otherwise, it's just irritating. I found it to be the irritating side of things. Although I did enjoy that, the dance-off argument between two university professors about who's the best mum, Hitler's mum or Elvis's mum. That was quite amusing. And there's quite a funny car chase that's sort of a little bit National Lampoon's, as you mentioned already. But I didn't love it at all. It didn't grab me at all. It just felt super arch and knowing and sort of irritatingly kind of pleased with itself.
His films, Baumbach's films, do hover on that knowingly arch kind of precipice, but usually are just held back enough not to be irritating. I mean, we should probably say this is Driver and Gerwig's first film together since Frances Ha, which they made about 10 years ago with Noah Baumbach, of course. And I absolutely love that film. That was just such a special piece of work. And you know, obviously Gerwig is together with Baumbach in real life, and Driver's worked with him a number of times since in While We Were Young and the absolutely brilliant Marriage Story from 2019, I think. So, you know, these guys have worked together a lot. They know each other very, very well. And this is something a little different for them. It is, you know, as you say, sort of slightly gone into this knowing Arch world, which you have to buy into. And some segments I really enjoyed. Some segments I found quite bizarre and mystifying. There's a, and this isn't really a spoiler, even though it comes at the end, there's a sort of strange dance sequence in the supermarket where all the characters are dancing. There's no real explanation for this. It just sort of happens. It's sort of cut to an LCD sound system track. And, it, you know, again, it's in this strange hyper-real sort of world. And then it turns into sort of a full song and dance number, which almost feels apt, I suppose, for this strange concoction that Baumbach's come up with. I mean, I've never read the book that it's based on, but I can't imagine it's an easy book to adapt. I don't think, you know, DeLillo's books generally are very, very easy.
It was called Unfilmable, wasn't it? So, you know,
it's in that bracket of difficult movies to sort of extract something from, or difficult books rather, to extract something from. It'd be interesting to see what hardcore Baumbach fans make of it. I think they'll probably get something out of it. For general audiences, I'm not sure, to be honest.
Yeah, and obviously they have hopes for this. This is a Netflix film, but it's going into cinemas first and then onto Netflix next month, which suggests ambition for awards. Obviously, you mentioned Marriage Story. That had, I think, 6 Oscar nominations when that came out and was, you know, a huge success. Do you think that this is in the same league as that? Is it going to trouble the Academy and BAFTA?
That's a good question. My gut feeling says no. It just feels a little bit too off-kilter for the Academy. But then again, I guess it's going to depend what else it's up against. And I mean, Marriage Story is a more traditional narrative. I mean, it's a sort of difficult and painful watch at times, but it's not as knowing as this film. You can see why Marriage Story was nominated. It also has sort of a showcase for some phenomenal performances. I don't think anyone in this is...
No.
Not that they're not doing their best work, that it's just that I don't think they've got the material to sort of do grandstanding performances that the Academy tends to go for. It's not going to be in Adam Driver's sort of highlight clips reel of his career, I would have thought, compared to, well, you know, Marriage Story or Frances Ha.
So this author's last adaptation was Cosmopolis, which nobody went for and was similarly kind of a bit yuck or yum, Marmite-y as a film. So, yeah, I don't see this being something that people embrace who are voters. But I do think it's one of those films that when it goes to Netflix will find an audience and people will kind of dig the primary coloured production design and the dance number that you're talking about. And, you know, also like Greta Gerwig's amazing wig. Astonishingly good. I'd like that wig. I'd like to wear that wig. It feels like you would feel very bubbly in it.
Next time we go to a film together, you must wear that wig.
I will wear a wig just like that. And the 80s wear that she has on, which is also quite delightful. But yeah, I think people will cherish it in a smaller way than it being a huge hit at the cinema or an awards contender.
Yeah, it's got, I mean, there's Jodie Turner-Smith turns up in it as a sort of brain box scientist. I quite enjoyed her. Yep. It's only a very small role, but I quite enjoyed her in it. You've got, I mean, even in the background, you've got virtually in the background, colleagues of the Adam Driver character. I mean, Don Cheadle is in a bigger role, but then I think Andre Holland pops up as one of their colleagues. So it's a great cast. And there are, you mentioned sort of the 80s. It is sort of a nod to those Amblin era films in a way, but it's quite a quirky nod. I mean, you know, you mentioned the car chase that has a sort of, I don't know, well, you said National Lampoon's, that kind of makes me think of E.T. as well, things like that. Just,
yeah,
you know, I mean, they could just get out their, you know, BMXs or grifters and they'll be away. But so some people who are yearning for a more old fashioned film might enjoy elements of this. I think it's quite a daring film in some ways. I mean, you can see, you know, Netflix have a great reputation for bankrolling difficult projects these days and things that they'll give a run to in the cinemas, which, you know, we all need to be grateful for, frankly, because I don't know how many studios would have made this film these days, as in, you know, the traditional studios. I guess you have to be thankful for that.
Yeah, I mean, they've put money into Bardo, the Inarritu film, which was challenging, to say the least. They also obviously just paid a whopping amount to create this new franchise in Knives Out. So they're sort of putting out genres and types of artistic endeavor that the sort of traditional studios seem a little shy of putting their money towards, because they're not going to see great returns immediately in the box office on some of these films. But they all seem to be films that will find an audience. You know, like, just because I didn't like White Noise doesn't mean I don't admire it and I can't see the sort of artistry in it. I do see that, but it is absolutely not for me. But if you fancy a go on it, it is in cinemas from this Friday, and then it hits Netflix on the 30th of December. So you can watch it after having a terrible Christmas with your family and enjoy a dysfunctional but also loving family on screen. Okay, shall we move on? I should probably say the next one of these backwards. It's this.
I do see the story of The Wizard of Oz as the story of David Lynch himself becoming a filmmaker.
David has gone over the rainbow from the very first film ever. He lives in a different reality than you or I do, and that's quite obvious.
Why would Lynch be that absorbed with The Wizard of Oz? Did he watch The Wizard of Oz on a perfect day, at the perfect time as a child, and it sort of baked into his subconscious?
Okay, so this is Lynch Oz. It's not David Lynch and Frank Oz. It's David Lynch and The Wizard of Oz. How so, James?
So this is a video essay, or video essays, I should say, looking at the influence of The Wizard of Oz on the work of David Lynch. The director, Alexander O'Philippe, who's done films in the past, he's done a lot of these kind of video essays on things like Alien and The Exorcist and John Ford. He's interviewed five filmmakers and one critic. And there, you don't see them on screen. It's just audio interviews which accompany clips that he and his editor have chosen to sort of illustrate their points, all revolving around different aspects of Lynch's relationship to The Wizard of Oz. So you've got a critic kicking it off, Amy Nicholson, who very much sort of contextualizes The Wizard of Oz. And then you get into this run of filmmakers, John Waters, the sort of trash king of films like Pink Flamingos. You've got Rodney Asher, who made Room 237, the sort of documentary about The Shining and people's obsession with that film. So he's perfect for this.
Yeah.
You've got David Lowery at the end, who did the brilliant The Green Knight. Karen Kusama, who did Girl Fight and more recently Destroyer. And then Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, who recently helmed episodes of Moon Knight. And they've just done season two of Loki. So, yeah, those are the guys that are giving their opinions. And it's just a fascinating deep dive into David Lynch, basically. I have to say, I'm not a massive fan of The Wizard of Oz in the sense that I've seen it. I appreciate it. It's just not a film I'm particularly obsessed by. But you can totally see why David Lynch is. He was clearly about, whatever, six or seven or something when he probably first saw it. I mean, he was born, I think, in 46, so the film had already been out for 7 years. So he would have presumably seen it on a rerun or something. But, yeah, it's just a classic example of a director who's seen a film at a very young age, and it's completely and utterly embedded in their psyche to the point now where, I mean, there's a quote where one of the best bits in the film is where Karen Kusama talks about going to see Mulholland Drive, Lynch's 2001 film, at a screening at the New York Film Festival. And an audience member asks him about his relationship to The Wizard of Oz, kind of completely out of the blue. And he basically says, "There isn't a day that goes past when I don't think about The Wizard of Oz," which is kind of probably, you know, for a man who's incredibly elusive in interviews and on stage Q&As and things, that's a pretty blunt answer to, yep, this film is huge for me. And, you know, there's one point in a documentary called David Lynch, The Art Life, which is about his paintings. you see a clip of him in his studio, and on the back, in the background on the wall, is a black and white still from The Wizard of Oz. That's clearly not been put there for any reason other than the fact that he loves the film. So, yeah, and it's just one of these sort of documentaries that, as far as I'm concerned, maybe A, wants to revisit Lynch's work, and B, makes you think about his work in a way you hadn't really considered before.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like any David Lynch film. And I really struggled with Twin Peaks. I remember when everyone was watching Twin Peaks and I was like, I don't like the log lady. I don't like the curtains. I don't like the talking backwards, you know, all of it, you know, Laura Palmer, the whole shebang. It's not for me. It's not anything that resonates with me. But again, as with the sort of white noise, I do admire him as an artist. And, you know, he is somebody who's got such a strong vision and a strong voice and artistic intent. So for me, this was actually really enlightening. And it's the perfect way for me to consume Lynch, because I don't actually have to watch the films to be seeing clips of it and to see, you know, how this huge, you know, impression that The Wizard of Oz has impacted all of his work, not only from sort of narrative arcs to, you know, red shoes to curtains, to the idea of the, you know, the awake life and the unconscious life, all of this. It's just like a really fantastic way to consume Lynch for me. So I really love this. And I'm a huge fan of The Wizard of Oz. So I loved all the aspects as well that they brought in, which was, you know, the myth that there's somebody who's committed suicide in the background of one of the scenes, the fact that the Munchkins all went absolutely wild when they were filming the film, and the sort of the tragic real life story that, you know, Judy Garland had that sort of informs your viewing of that film. So it's really a way of viewing both of these things and seeing them through different lenses. And it's for the ultimate film nerd, and it gives you such good bragging rights down the pub, doesn't it? You could totally like impress someone over a pint with your knowledge of Lynch's oeuvre with this film by sort of quoting bits of it. It's so nerdy and delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now I can tell you that Garland Avenue is a street address that's mentioned in Lost Highway, which I didn't know before. Yeah. And, you know, there's so many references to the name Judy. To Garland, yeah. to Dorothy. I mean, obviously, you've got Dorothy Valance in Blue Velvet, but that's quite an obvious one. But then I think at the end of Inland Empire, you see Laura Dern collapsing on the Hollywood sort of Walk of Fame, you know, Hollywood Sunset Boulevard, and, you know, collapsing near a star that sort of says Dorothy. And, it, you know, there's just lots and lots. I guess it's when you put all that stuff together, you're like, oh, my God, it really is all the way through his work. And, yeah, I think it... And undoubtedly makes you rethink The Wizard of Oz as well as a film, and or at least gain new appreciation for it.
I mean, I think we all know The Wizard of Oz is quite screwed up and dark. But when you start to look at it through a Lynch lens, you're saying like, God, this is so weird and trippy. And, you know, the way that it's also kind of informed John Waters as well, in a way, he sort of talks about his own sort of relationship to the film as well. It just makes you really appreciate cinema as well. You don't have to be into any of these artists' work to appreciate the joy that cinema is. The fact that, you know, the sort of end note that of this is the grace note of it, is that isn't it amazing that we can talk for an hour and a half about various different disciplines and artists' work and find something common to discuss and fascinate about and be obsessed over, and that anyone can watch a film and, you know, take different things from it and see different things in it and take meaning from different things, and that meaning can be entirely different from what the director or the writer intended, and that's the beauty of it. So I loved the fact that it was this real celebration of celluloid.
So this hasn't though convinced you to revisit Lynch in any capacity?
No.
Not even Mulholland Drive?
Especially not that one. That was a make it end for me. No, I really don't love his... I love them in bite size in this. This is perfect for me. I see all the best bits and I see the sort of the theorising about them, and I'm intrigued and delighted by it, but I don't want to watch a whole film.
Interesting. He is very funny, though. I will say that. I mentioned at the beginning sort of seeing Lost Highway earlier, and there's a sequence where one of the sort of slightly villainous characters ends up with his head kind of pierced on a glass coffee table. And then one of the detectives refers to him as Mr. Denthead, which I just find hilarious. But that's just a slightly macabre part of my sense of humor, I suppose. But
yeah,
he's dark and twisted. I mean, what can you say?
Yeah, I love the fact that he's dark and twisted and opaque and sort of mischievous and doesn't give anything away. And that even in this film, we see that on a talk show, he just says, "I just want to say hi to Judy." And the host is like, "Who's Judy?" And he's like, "A friend." And who knows? Who knows whether he's talking about Judy Garland or his this figure of Judy that he's invented that's part of his work that is a, you know, a nod to her. Who knows? But he's just got that cheeky, enigmatic smile. And so, yeah, as an artist, I think he's amazing. But sorry, Dave, don't love the films.
Not even The Elephant Man? I'm just trying here now. I'm just throwing ones out.
Okay, yeah. You know what? Yes, The Elephant Man, I adore, and I watched that numerous times as a kid. But it doesn't involve sort of curtains and red shoes, so I think that's probably... It's one of his most linear and sort of...
I'm not sure if it even gets mentioned in this film. It might do. June briefly comes up in this film, but very, very briefly. I think Eraserhead is sort of kind of alluded to, but I think the bulk of this concentrates on sort of the Blue Velvet to... Well, from there onwards to Twin Peaks, basically.
Yes. And Twin Peaks Returns obviously has a lot of references to Wizard of Oz. Those red curtains, velvet curtains, loves a velvet curtain, does Lynch, doesn't he? And who doesn't? I do too. Okay, so if you fancy delving into the psyche of David Lynch and sort of getting nerdy with The Wizard of Oz, Lynch Oz is out in cinemas on Friday, and I highly recommend it, even if you've never seen a frame of either. It's fascinating. Okay, so before we move on, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, The Last Picture Show. This is a seasonal podcast where we ask people to choose the last four films they would put on a big screen if there was going to be no more cinema. You can find episodes on your podcast platform by searching for Total Films Last Picture Show. Right, should we move on then? It's our final film now, and if you go down to the woods today, you might find this.
Lady Chatterley.
Sorry, I didn't mean to intrude.
Do you want to come in? To the field,
shades of green. Ever to have visited the estate. Covered by the winds,
two hearts bloom and millions. Connie's exhausted. Who do you think's taking care of her while she's taking care of you?
I don't think I realised how lonely I've been. Till now.
So this is Netflix's sumptuous adaptation of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. For those of us who are not au fait with the story, James, set it up for us.
So this is, as you say, based on D.H. Lawrence's novel, which came out in the late 1920s, extremely controversial, particularly in England, where it was caught up in an obscenity trial much later on. It's basically about... Constance Connie, Lady Chatterley herself, who marries Clifford, her husband. It all seems very idyllic, but then Clifford, of course, goes off to war. He comes back injured, and really their relationship begins to crumble from there. And at the point where he also hires Mellors, the gamekeeper, to look after the estate. In this case, played by Jack O'Connell. And gradually, Mellors and Connie have an affair, and a very passionate, erotic affair. And she finds a level of freedom and self-expression with him that she clearly isn't getting with Clifford. It's an absolutely classic story that's been retold many, many times. I should add, it's Emma Corrin playing Constance. Emma Corrin, who played Diana in the previous season of The Crown, and we have Matthew Duckett playing Clifford, and then in a nice little addition, Joni Richardson, who plays Mrs. Bolton, the sort of housekeeper that comes into the story. And Joni previously played Constance in I think it was 1993 BBC version with Sean Bean. So it's quite a nice little circle that they've cast her again in a very different role.
That was a formative watch for me. Don't know about you, James. Old Sean Bean and Joni Richardson down in the woods. And that, when that came out, was quite a sort of racy thing, wasn't it? People were a bit clutching their pearls and writing to points of view about, you know, sort of assignments in the forest. This is quite different in as much as this is directed by a woman. So this is very much through a female gaze. And this is very much more about the eroticism, as you mentioned, being about self-expression, about being about fusing with somebody on a soul level, not just about bonking in the woods. Does it succeed on that level, James?
Yeah, I think it kind of does, actually. Because you, these days you can't shock in the way that even in 1993, which isn't really that long ago, and as you said, people were shocked. I guess it was a BBC primetime drama in that case. But even then, that was shocking. And even then in 93, that's probably still only 30-odd years ahead of when that obscenity trial was. So we've probably come a long way since 93 and certainly since the early 1960s in that it's pretty difficult to shock people anymore with any sort of sexual content. I mean, this is explicit, but it's not that explicit. There's plenty of, you know, erotic couplings. But I think the filmmakers know that they can't exist just on that. They can't exist on that sort of titillation. They have to find something else deep within the story. Yeah, I did enjoy it as a sort of a revisit of that story. I think it's beautifully made as well. It looks
gorgeous,
but not in that kind of, oh, it's a period drama, let's just do, I don't know, lots of, I mean, there are lots of landscape shots and things like that. You get to see the, you know, the Nottinghamshire sort of mills in the background and things like that, which obviously was CGI'd, but let's not break the magic. But it just captures that sort of 1920s, 1930s sort of period really, really well without being too, oh, hey, look at us, aren't we doing a great now magic hour sunset kind of shot. I just think it felt very natural. I think the costumes are really beautiful as well.
Oh, they're so gorgeous. I wanted everything she wore.
Again, they just, without trying too hard, it really captures that spirit of that era and probably what it was like, to at least if you had a certain amount of money and were living in that in those sort of circumstances. So, I thought it was a really impressive piece of work. And, I mean, again, a bit like White Noise, obviously it is on Netflix. I think it is getting a sort of small cinema release, but I think people will catch it on Netflix because it's, you know, it's got a sexy cast. I mean, Jack O'Connell, obviously, he has a lot of fans, and I would definitely recommend watching it.
And if you sort of enjoyed what Emma Corrin did with Diana, there is a sort of echo of that here, in as much as Lady Chatterley is sort of trapped in this marriage where her husband isn't interested in her physically, you know, says to her, go out and get pregnant by another man in order to get me an heir, which is just to sort of completely diminish her entirely in terms of what she does for him, spiritually, emotionally, physically. And so, you know, this woman going out and looking for that connection with somebody that she's not getting in her marriage is something that Emma Corrin does very, very well and very sort of soulfully and emotively. And I thought that their performance was really beautiful. The sex scenes, we should probably talk about them. I mean, obviously, they had a lot of intimacy coordinators on set. These were very much consensual and everybody was fully on board with this. But as you say, that they are graphic in as much as there's nudity. We, you know, there's full frontal nudity from both. And it is, you know, sex scenes in different positions. And I mean, I'm worried about the cold that they're going to get, the amount of disrobing in the forest and sitting on prickly things, but you do you. It doesn't feel dirty or, for, you know, sort of titillating, as you say. It feels really like these people are, you know, joining together spiritually via sex, and that sex is a conduit for this woman to feel empowered. And so I think that works really successfully. Let's also talk about the fact that they went one step further with this and changed the ending. No spoilers of what it is, but they did decide to deviate from the book. Was that successful for you?
That's a good question. One never really likes endings tampered with from classic literature. It didn't mortally offend me, but yeah, I guess that probably isn't one of the better aspects of the film. But hey, it still felt in keeping somehow with the tone that they'd set, if that makes sense. Bit hard to talk about without talking about what exactly they do. But yeah, I didn't think it was out of character for the film, if that makes sense.
Yes, it felt very much in keeping, and the director has talked about the fact that D.H. Lawrence had envisaged sort of revisiting the sort of continuing story of Mellors and Lady Chatterley and what might happen after the close of that book. So it feels as though it's not completely out of kilter to try to sort of explore what that might be. But obviously purists will not like the fact that it deviates. I personally did like it because it's very much in the idea that this film is exploring of a woman's right to happiness and a right to have agency and a right to have agency over her own body, which, you know, although it's the 1920s and it's about a different set of circumstances, feels very current to now and the conversations that we're still having about this. So for me, I felt like it felt modern, but also classic and worked really well.
Yeah, and I Lady Chatterley's as a novel is probably one of those absolute key texts in terms of feminist empowerment. How many people of a much younger generation to me, how many people know the book? I don't know, but it's something that hopefully this might encourage them to, you know, at least if not read the book, read a little bit more about it and, you know, find out more about it. And, you know, anything that, you know, gives D.H. Lawrence a push up the charts is good for me.
I wondered where you were going with that, with a push up where, considering his material. And it is also interesting, isn't it, that, you know, it was so outrageous when this book came out that a woman would want sex. You know, that seemed to be the crux of it. How disgusting for people to read about a woman's desires. And, you know, we're in a day and age now where we're trying to, you know, say that women should not be ashamed of their sexual desires and needs and wants. And this film really does illustrate that it's not something to be ashamed of. And it's not to be, you know, not to be slut shamed, which is essentially what people did when the book came out, that this was a disgusting idea. So, yeah, it's really interesting. I think it will prompt conversation. And Corran is just great. I just think, you know, with My Policeman, which, you know, is not a great film, but
I've still not seen My Policeman.
Their performance in that is really, really good. And also in The Crown. I just think one to watch, really. I can't wait to see what they do next. Okay, so we are saying Lady Chatterley is definitely a good date. If you fancy that, it's in cinemas from Friday and is obviously going to Netflix after that. Right, time to continue for Star Wars Wars. Last week, Neil argued for Yoda against Darth Vader. And you voted, 67.6% of people said Vader ruled over Yoda at 32.4%. So Vader once again returns to fight another day, James. Now, you've brought a character before.
And that failed miserably.
And that failed again. I mean, I just think maybe...
I had to listen to last week's pod just so I could find out what happened to my vote. And Boba Fett just went nowhere, basically.
Nowhere.
And, you know, Neil's argument for Yoda was very sound, and I know you were very much on board with that. But I'm thinking, well, if Vader beats, what is it so far, Lando, Boba Fett, Yoda, I mean, where the hell else are we going to go? So I've gone for, well, a bit like I did with Boba Fett, I'm going to up the cool factor. I'm going to go for Princess Leia.
Governor Tarkin, I should have expected to find you holding Vader's leash. I recognized your foul stench when I was brought on board.
I don't know where you get your delusions, laser brain.
Why, you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
I mean, it's Carrie Fisher for a start.
Yeah, cool.
I could just say Carrie Fisher, that's my argument, and we leave it at that. But, you know, she's the one that fronts up to, you know, Governor Tarkin in the Death Star and refers to his stench. I mean, she really just doesn't care about these scary men in black capes and black boots and things like that. She's super hard. You know, she's also got the Force, as we ultimately discover. You know, yes. She's very much part of that family. But by The Last Jedi, then when you see the kind of stuff that she can do, no spoilers in case someone out there still hasn't seen it, but there's she really can pull the tricks, basically. So, yeah, I mean, she's Princess Leia. What more do I need to say than that?
And she's also, you know, the catalyst for, you know, the Rogue One team bringing those plans to her, that the entire franchise begins with, you know, her being pursued across the stars by Vader, because she has these plans in her hands. You know, Leia really kicks off this entire world and to some degree, I would say, again, no spoilers, ends it. So she feels incredibly important. And also, you know, as we argued with Yoda, a force for good and the lightness of this world, while Vader is the darkness. So I think it's a really good shout, James. I'm wondering if the girl power and just, you know, formidable nature of Leia could actually kick old Buckethead out of this war. What do you reckon?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we haven't even mentioned she even strangles Jabba the Hutt with a chain.
How can we forget that she does that whilst wearing a very uncomfortable looking bikini?
Very uncomfortable looking, but one that's inspired even Ross and Rachel in Friends. So, well, I mean, you know, that's probably one of the greatest pop culture memes that Star Wars has ever, you know, introduced. I think that is what the one thing about her as a creation, as a character, she wasn't just, you know, a sort of pretty face that is dragged along the adventures. She very much was at the, you know, that early moment when they're trying to bust her out of the Death Star and she just grabs a laser gun and starts firing.
Yeah.
I mean, that just sums her up as a character, basically.
Yeah, and she's just so dismissive of Han Solo. He's like, hey, baby, and she's just like, no, not interested. You can't impress me. I'm like, kick-ass. I don't need any of this in my life. And the fact that, you know, he is so in love with her. You know, this man who probably, I'm going to say, could have quite a lot of ladies in various solar systems. You know, Leia is the one he wants, you know, and she ultimately acquiesces to love him too. You know, that's an amazing partnership as well. I do think she's amazing. So yeah. I'm fully on board with this choice. We will put it to a Twitter vote and see if old Vader wins again. It can't be this much darkness in the universe, James. I mean, why do people keep voting for him? I mean, I know he's great.
He is pretty, yeah, he is great. And he is probably the most iconic villain in any movie ever made. So that's, and you know, the villains always seem to have more fun. Vader does have this incredible tragic arc as well. You know, again, spans the entire sort of franchise. But, you know, there's got to be some love for Leia out there.
Yes. Bring it on for Leia. Okay, so do check out Twitter and please vote and let us know who survives to fight another day next week. Okay, so that's it. That's all we have time for. Film of the week, James?
I'm going for Lynch, Oz.
Yeah, I think I am too, which I really wouldn't have thought when I looked at this list, but I think it is such a little gem of nerdy delight. Okay, before we go, we should say please subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy listening to us waffle on about film. It makes us feel lovely and warm inside, but also, you know, just helps you because it just pops into your inbox. Right, before we go, we have time for a listener's question. This is a bit random, but I like it. What's the greatest use of a guitar in movies?
I got a bit stuck on this one, but then I went, oh, yeah, Back to the Future.
Oh, classic.
And I had to look up what the guitar was, but it's a Gibson ES-345. This is obviously when he jumps on stage, he plays Johnny B. Goode, good old Marty McFly. And it's just such, I remember being how old I would have been when I saw that film, like, I don't know, 13 or something. And just that moment, and I didn't really know the song particularly well at that age, but it's such a sort of glorious moment. I mean, it's obviously completely tied into the plot when he's playing this guitar. He doesn't smash it up. He doesn't do anything rock and roll.
He does play that really high note at the end when everyone's
aghast. Well, that's right. He does go on his knees and plays that incredible note at the end. But it's just such a cool guitar sequence. And a cool guitar.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to go for This Is Spinal Tap and the moment when a guitar is brought out and we have a whole conversation about a stain on the guitar. It's one of the many scenes that's very funny, along with, you know, turning it up to 11. But yeah. Great guitars and movies. I think I'm going to do top 10 guitars and movies for the next issue. I'm inspired now.
That's very good.
I might shove a banjo in just to be, you know, perverse.
Just because. It's a stringed guitar-esque thing, instrument.
Guitar-esque. I mean, kind of works. Okay. Well, on that note, see what I did there? We will say goodbye. Say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Bye.
Excellent. Way down in the
handsome I'll ever